Welcome back to Broad Appeal, Good, Bad, Crazy, Judi Dench Edition. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
Brian, we loved Philomena, did we not?
Yes, we absolutely did. We thought that while a commercial picture, it had layers upon layers like an Irish onion.
Okay, well now I'm going to present you with a film that looks like some European art house, when in fact is a load of tosh.
It's not an onion, it's not a lovely loaf of fruited brack. Instead, it is a very, very thin bolognese. It is tea that has not steeped long enough.
It's Tea with Mussolini, also known as the movie equivalent of a Pandoro. You know, the most boring dessert ever created.
Are you referring to a panettone?
Yeah, Pandoro, I think, is the name brand, but a panettone. It's huge, and it's pointless.
And it's puffy, and it looks nice on the outside, but when you cut it open, it's nothing but fluff.
Yeah, and it's not sweet enough either.
I guarantee you that director Franco Zeffirelli gives unwanted panettones to every family member that he has, and every, you know, rent boy that he's ever slept with every Christmas.
I bet every year there's a big hoo-ha about cutting the panettone, and everybody has to feign interest as he does it.
They're like, oh, here goes a Franco again with his panettone. We must be nice to him because he's so close to Berlusconi.
Now, I should interject right here and say, dear listeners, if you hear any banging within, we're getting a new facade here at Palazzo Rocanera on Rushcroft Road, Brixton.
Which is a fancy way of saying that the flat downstairs, they're doing the bathroom up. But actually, Sean, your notions, the notions that you have of referring to our humble flat as a palazzo, they are in line with the characters of this film, Tea with Mussolini. You know, notions and pretensions are what these women are all about, aren't they?
Yeah, notions, pretensions, and one dimensions.
Very well put. Mm-hmm. And it rhymes. You are a poet on the order of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Okay, so this movie is a cavalcade of grand dame actresses. There's at least three dames in this film. Possibly more. Maybe there were some hidden dames that I didn't see. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure, actually, if they were all dames in 1999 when this film is released. But they're either dames now or they're dead. So who are they?
Well, you know what, Brian? It doesn't matter either way, quite honest with you. So there's Joan Plowright, Maggie Smith, Judi Dench, who we'll talk more about, Lily Tomlin, and President Cher.
Yes, Cher gets the memorable honor of representing not only America, but also Jewry. So she is a rich Jewish heiress who marries men for their fortunes and also is in love with art. Is this the second film we've seen in which Cher was of the Hebrew persuasion?
What's the first one?
Mermaids, darling, Mermaids.
Oh, yes, of course, Mermaids. Because I was going to say, Brian, Moonstruck is about Italians.
Cher is the female version of Oscar Isaac. She can kind of completely be any ethnicity whatsoever, as long as it's not, like, Swedish.
Yeah, well, these days, Cher is kind of more and more ghostly. You know what I mean? Have you ever seen pictures of Cher from decades previous, where she definitely has melanin in her skin, and now she's kind of marble-like?
Wax-like.
Yes.
So Cher is the American heiress. Lily Tomlin is a seemingly lesbian journalist.
She's an archaeologist.
Is she an archaeologist? Yeah, you're right. No, she is an archaeologist. She wears a pith helmet some of the time. I mean, honestly, the fact that we're so vague about Lily Tomlin's character is further indication. I mean, she has absolutely nothing to do in this plot line. I'm not even sure why she's in there at all. But the three main women are Joan, Judi, and Maggie. As you said, they are all three-dimensional, but only if you add up the three characters together. So that means they each have one dimension each.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So let's just list what those dimensions are. The emotional center of the film is not Judi Dench at all. It's Joan Plowright. Now, Sean, do you have any previous experience of Joan Plowright?
I don't ever remember not knowing who she is, but at the same time, I don't ever remember knowing who she is.
Well, she has a long and venerable stage career. I'm sure if you'd been around at the Old Vic in 1964, you could have possibly caught her as Mistress Quickly or something in The Merry Wives of Windsor.
Well, we don't all have your fortune, Brian.
I also have another question for you, Sean. If you were a bisexual genius actor director and you had a choice between marrying Vivien Leigh or Joan Plowright, whom would you choose?
Well, could I just marry Vivien Leigh first and then wait for her to die and then marry Joan Plowright? Is that the correct order?
That is the absolutely correct order, as exemplified by Sir Laurence Olivier.
Yeah, well, obviously Laurence Olivier truly loves Joan Plowright.
Yeah, or maybe he was just worn down by Vivien Leigh's, hijinks.
Yeah, he was probably like, oh, thank God, a plain, ordinary British woman. I love you.
Can we just quickly say anything about Joan Plowright? She is actually quite good in this. She's the sort of most grandmotherly of the old ladies.
As far as I'm concerned, Brian, she's an indistinguishable old lady.
No, didn't you? Okay, so basically, this is the story of a little boy, right? A little Italian boy called Luca, yeah? Mm-hmm. He's played by a particularly cherubic child when he's young, and then he's played by a quite baby-faced, but equally fey, teenage boy when he gets older.
Yeah, kind of like a bargain bin Jonathan Groff.
Yes, exactly. It's like, he doesn't even really seem Italian, and the name of the actor in the credits had no trace of Italianate lineage. It was something like Baird Wallace or something like that. So, anyway, that's Luca. He's a little orphan boy. He's a bastardino who's been disowned by his father, the dress importer.
His mother sadly died. She was a costumier, I believe.
The father wants the boy to be raised as a true English gentleman. We're talking about 1933 Florence, by the way. So he kind of fobs the boy off to this collection of grand dames, these English ladies who live in Florence.
Yeah, known as the Scorpioni.
Because beware of their bite. But they absolutely have no bite. I mean, all they could bite into is a
scone.
Yeah, a scone or possibly even a petit
four. Or a panettone, petit four. That's as sharp as their teeth go.
So the least sharp of all is Joan Plowright, who's the most motherly to him. She has two beloved relatives who died in the Great War. And what sort of things does she do with Luca? She educates him, you know?
Yes.
I mean, did you ever have a lovely maiden aunt who set up a fabulous toy theater out of cardboard and enacted scenes of Romeo and Juliet with you?
Well, not quite that, but I did cut out pages of the New Yorker with an aunt.
That's quite lovely. I mean, both you and I have quite close relationships with aunts in our lives from when we were young. And we have also both turned out gay. So in a way, it would seem like we ought to really relate to young Luca, and perhaps to Franco Zeffirelli himself. But do we?
Well, you know what, Brian? You're right. Being gay is not a choice. It is foisted upon you by women.
Especially if those women are your mother's or father's sisters.
Yes.
That is what I have concluded from watching Tea with Mussolini.
That was a great episode, Brian. I'll see you in part three.
So, I mean, you know, Joan Plowright is very, very nice. She instills an awful lot of Shakespeare into young Luca. I guess we should save Judi Dench for last. So what about Maggie Smith? She doesn't really take much interest in Luca. She's far more concerned with geopolitical matters.
Yeah, she's far more concerned with sympathizing with fascism.
And again, this would be an interesting character, I suppose, were it not for the fact that Maggie Smith has essentially already played this role.
Yeah.
Like, literally.
Yeah, I mean, the resemblances to Miss Jean Brodie are there, but they're not concrete enough to really merit us comparing them.
The thing about Miss Jean Brodie, yes, she is an English fascist sympathizer and deluded, but she's also an interesting, clever, charismatic, charming, attractive woman who draws all of her girls to her.
Yes, her Brodie set.
Yes, indeed. I love it when you pull out that Maggie Smith impression. But in this one, she is the widow of the British ambassador, still stationed in Florence. And for some reason that is completely unclear, she spends the entire length of World War II still convinced that Mussolini, who has literally imprisoned her is still a sympathetic character. And there is absolutely no reason given for this. Do you know what I mean?
Well, isn't the reason given that, foolishly in this film, Mussolini is present? It's one of the many things that we found ridiculous about it.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I could have enjoyed a film called Tea with Mussolini if it was all building up to some climax, maybe 80 to 90% of the way into the film, where finally Maggie Smith gets to meet Mussolini.
Yeah, Yul Brynner plays it. Or Ben Kingsley. You know, one of those types.
That would have been good. Or possibly Albert Finney with his Daddy Warbucks bald cap.
Or Danny DeVito, if budgets really didn't allow it.
Instead, it's some interchangeable Italian actor who's quite short and bald, and the meeting with Mussolini comes about halfway through the film, so there's absolutely no sense of true menace of an actual fascist dictator. He's just some little boring character actor who she's had a couple of scenes with.
Yeah, and the whole premise on which this film is based is that for some reason Mussolini gives a damn about these British women and is not going to, you know, chuck them out or something.
Or kill them. Well, he does at least...
he does at least imprison them.
He imprisons them as enemy aliens, but I guess we can get to that. We haven't talked anything about Judi Dench.
That's very good, Lucas. For 7, that's excellent. It's much better than a lot of amateur artists.
Okay, so this movie, it was released in 1999. We're not exactly sure when it was filmed. If it came out in 99, this means that Judi Dench had just won her Academy Award for Shakespeare in Love. Definitely her career ascendance was well on the way up. She maybe wasn't the Judi Dench phenomenon that we know now, but she was a nobody. What do you think was the conversation between her and Franco Zeffirelli when she was handed this script?
Well, she probably thought to herself, oh, I do love Italy, and oh, dear old Maggie is taking part. Sign me up.
Well, of course, they'd been together in Italy before in A Room with a View, also in Florence.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly, in that film, Maggie Smith has by far the bigger, showier part. And she's still bigger and showier in this one. But I would say that nowadays, when we think of Judy and Maggie in the same breath, you know, it's really probably Judi Dench who's probably eclipsed Maggie as a kind of box office icon and draw, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's interesting because this is, what, 5 years after both the Sister Act films, okay? Maggie Smith has carved herself a little niche as being the imperious, haughty, completely mildly outraged at all times dowager.
Do you think she ever gets tired of that?
Yeah, but the thing is, like, when you've had a lengthy career, it's kind of like the shit that Pacino does these days. He probably says, you know what, I've done The Godfather, I would like to buy another holiday home. So I will be in this Adam Sandler film.
I wonder if Maggie Smith, I have no idea if she's still married or if her husband is alive or deceased or whatever, but I can only hope that around the house she behaves incredibly sweetly and pliantly with everyone else, because if she both in her work and in her life was that continual pinched grouchiness at all times, I think that would just become like completely insufferable for her and everyone around her.
No, I get the impression that she's pretty chill.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so Judy's decided she could do with a, you know, a Ryanair flight to Italy. She signs on the dotted line for Franco Zeffirelli, and she's thinking about her character. And what is Franco saying to her about who... Her character is named Arabella.
Arabella. So, first day of set. Your character, her name is... let's call you Arabella, okay? And she's like, dear Franco, what's my motivation? And he says, your motivation is you love your dog. And you are, as you British say, fretting about the dog in the fresco.
Yes. So basically, Judy in this, her character Arabella is the artsy one. And I have to say, if anyone's listening to this who was with me at the time that I was at Oxford, I actually did know a British woman who carried around a small dog with her. This woman was the vocal coach on a production of The Taming of the Shrew that I appeared in. The dog's name was Willoughby, and this vocal coach would carry her in a little bag. So such women who are obsessed with small yapping dogs in Britain do exist.
Oh, all the way since 1930s, apparently.
Arabella is obsessed with her dog. She takes her dog to the vet. The emotional, you know, high point of the film is one moment where she's separated. The black shirts have taken her dog away from her, and her hair is flowing out of the police van as she's being pulled away, and she's screaming. You would think it was, you know, Sophie's Choice, but instead it's just the dog being taken away. And the dog doesn't even die. She gets reunited with the dog at the end.
Okay, this is not a spoiler, dear listeners, but nobody dies. Okay?
Wait, but it's a World War II film, Sean.
Yeah, nobody dies. Nothing really gets destroyed. Nobody gets separated. The prison they're in is kind of like a Center Parks, you know,
it's like a nice pensione. They probably got it on Airbnb.
Yeah, it's this film. This film is 2 hours long, and nothing happens.
I should also say that in addition to the dog, Judi Dench also cares a lot about art. So she takes Luca to the Uffizi. They copy, you know, the sculptures and the Botticellis and the paintings. And I have to say, if you were to go by this film, you would think that the worst thing the fascists ever did is come into the Uffizi and take a tea tray from a bunch of old ladies and throw it out a window.
We always make tea here.
There is a change of policy. Go and drink your tea in one of your colonies. This is a free and civilized country. Avanti, ripulite! Ripulite tutto le tue cose. Su!
And I was thinking to myself, well, good for them, because they shouldn't have hot beverages next to priceless works of art. Do you know what I mean? Like, am I really supposed to get all that worked up because, you know, Arabella can't sip Lapsang Souchong next to the Venus de Milo?
Well, you know what this film is about? It's about the liberties that the British have taken for centuries, and how suddenly they get upset when they're told they can't do something.
I mean, honestly, these women are ludicrous. There's a war clearly raging around them. There are fascists marching in the street, and there's
Oh, but they're so polite, Brian.
They're very polite to Maggie Smith. There's absolutely no reason why they should stay on in Italy. I mean, maybe, I'm sure historically there were these women, and supposedly this is based on some experience that Franco Zeffirelli did have as a child.
Well, it's based on an autobiography that he wrote, so
but I
hope.
Mean, there's no motivation given for why these diehard women want to stay in Italy and not return to England.
Brian, you have the choice to go back to Folkestone, or you can stay in a crumbling palazzo. You waited on hand and foot by fascists.
But there's only one lavatory.
How are we to have privacy?
And actually, when you talk about being waited on hand and foot by fascists, it is very clear that Franco Zeffirelli's aesthetic sense was applied not only to the frescoes and the busts and the decor, but also to the numerous men who he cast as the carabinieri and the various fascist black shirts, right?
Because yeah, there's a few nice jug-eared, pencil-mustached, café au lait-coloured fascist soldiers who get to show their chests in the most fleeting of glances.
Yes, I mean, I really would have expected a bit more heat, especially when there's a young, budding homosexual boy among them. But
yeah, but Pasolini this is not.
No, it is not Pasolini in the slightest. How did you feel about the costuming, Sean? So there are a number of credited costume designers, one of whom is Jenny Bevan.
Yeah, Jenny Bevan, who we love.
Well, Jenny Bevan, she's done tons and tons of period pieces, including that memorable period piece, Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, love her.
But this is one of those really old-fashioned movies where there's, like, the main people who did the costumes, and then one of the stars gets her own costume credit.
Yeah, so a whole particular title on the credit sequence is Cher's costume designed by Ermanno Dalli for the Schervino collection, and Jules designed by Maria Menarini for the Grisono.
So you just kind of think to yourself, oh, this is going to be luscious and sumptuous, because I associate those, you know, gowns by Adrian type of things with the absolute most incredible creations. And it has to be said, Cher has a few nice outfits. She shows up in a Jaguar with a kind of amazing hat.
She had some nice tailoring that I can see myself in as well.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you better call the Schiervino collection, see if they're still around. But the thing is, it's by no means particularly sumptuous. Like, would you give this the Oscar for Best Costume Design?
No, I don't believe it's got any Oscar nominations whatsoever.
I'm going to put myself on a limb there and say that actually the best costumes are those that are worn by Judi Dench. Because since she's like the artsy one, she kind of wears what I could only describe as a carpet kind of worn over herself. She looks a little bit like Dumbledore some of the time with like a carpet and a velvet beret. And it made me wonder, I wonder if she personally supplied these outfits from Jennifer's in Oxford. What
yes,
do you think?
Smocks by Jennifer. I love a nice smock. You know what I do.
It's entirely possible. All right. I mean, we've basically laid out who all the characters are. We know that the war starts to intrude on their lives. They've been tending to little gay Luca. For some reason, Maggie Smith really hates Cher. I mean, why?
Oh, because she's a brash, ignorant American, babe. What do you think?
I mean, do you think there's a coded thing that she hates Cher because Cher is meant to be a Jew?
No, I really don't. I think she hates Cher because Cher is brash and ignorant and loud and ostentatious.
But it's just like, it's this driving engine of the plot that Cher is just goodness personified, right? First of all, she loves modern art. At one point, she gets her art dealer to purchase literally every famous painting that has ever existed from, like, 1916 to 1935.
Yeah, so basically, it's MoMA in her living room.
Elsa, darling!
Don't give me that Elsa, darling, crap!
Elsa,
now, where's my goddamn Picasso?
If you send the money when I call...
I told you that Morgenthau wouldn't give me the money then, Chezzy! God damn it! Wait, buy it back! Offer them more money!
No, Elsa, please!
And I want it now! Georgie!
There's like the Dadaists, the Surrealists, and there's the Demoiselle d'Avignon is like right there above her sofa.
She's putting coffee mugs on yet-to-be-hung paintings.
This hot beverage issue is just rife through this entire film. Where was the curatorial consultation? So anyway, there's a plotline about her love of art, and she's also just good-hearted. You know, they do make passing lip service to the fact that Jews in Italy are being rounded up, and we get a kind of nameless Jewish woman who is helped by Cher, who gets her a passport.
Yes, in a scene of almost dramatic tension.
In a scene of almost 5 seconds.
Yeah.
She employs little Luca, who is not in prison because he is Italian, to ride around on his little bicycle and deliver bribes and cash grants and secret passports to the Victor Laszlos of the Scorpioni, you know? But, like, Casablanca, this is not.
No.
There's absolutely no tension as to whether any of these people are going to escape, or no sense of threat or consequence.
Yeah, it is shocking how little tension there is in this film.
And basically, then, once America joins the war, Cher and Lily Tomlin also join them in the hotel. But by this point, Cher has begun an affair with the most barrel-chested and most jug-eared and most pencil-mustached man, who really was quite hot.
He was quite hot. And you know what? Just before I get really annoyed with Franco Zeffirelli.
Okay, go on. Yeah.
You're a gay man and you're making a story about your life. It's your male gaze. And you can tell that he's a conservative homosexual. By the way, I use the word homosexual because that is what Franco Zeffirelli prefers to be called.
He doesn't like to be called gay.
No, he finds gay to be too crass, too vulgar for his tastes.
Well, as Tom Stoppard said in The Invention of Love, homosexual is a terrible word because it combines Greek and Latin together.
Well, I should also say at this point he was known as Senator Franco Zeffirelli for a center-right party from 1994-2001. Where he found time to make this film when he should have been in the Senate, I do not know. I call for an independent inquiry. Thank you very much.
Where is
which will take about 7 years to get off the page.
7 years?
Knowing Italian bureaucracy.
What's that guy's name? Mario Monti.
Oh, he's no longer president.
I know, but yeah, he's no longer president because he was doing too many of those types of inquiries, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, enough of Italian politics. We'd be here all day. So, wait, what were we saying? Oh, so he's cast this barrel-chested hunky man, and you're saying there's absolutely no homosexual content, or really even sexual content. I mean, you've got Cher in bed with a hunky guy, And they're just sort of lying there with the sheets up to their navels.
Yeah, and it's one of those films where I'm so desperate for there to be any sex appeal whatsoever that I'm totally projecting, like, lust onto every knee I get to see. There's one point where the hunky... He doesn't have a name.
Vittorio.
Vittorio, yeah, that's correct, it is Vittorio. The hunky Vittorio gets out and he puts on, like, Cher's robe. And then he kind of, like, pulls the chest open a little bit so his tits are popping. And that's all we get.
The fascinating thing is that the autobiographical stand-in, Luca, who presumably is Zeffirelli himself, he is supposedly in love with Cher, mm-hmm. right? And we all know that a 16-year-old boy who is in love with Cher is clearly gay, right?
Well, I have to say, okay, if I was 16 again... And there was a gorgeous hunky man and Cher standing side by side. I would get very confused because I would be drawn to Cher.
No, absolutely. But the thing is, he becomes insanely jealous that Cher is spending her time with the hunky chauffeur.
Yeah, where's the transference, Brian?
Yeah, but this is... There could have been a passionate or interesting representation. I mean, can we cast our minds back to 1999? Could there really be absolutely no hint of a burgeoning homosexuality here whatsoever?
You know what, though? This is that weird period in filmmaking. Like, I feel the last... say 7, 8, 9 years in mainstream film have actually really been great, because I just think people and audiences are cottoning on that they want some realistic blood, you know, metaphorical and literally
cinematic Viagra pumping yeah. through some limp screenplays.
It's like films like this and Chocolat and, you know, all the other ones that were kind of going around at this time, they don't mean anything. They're nothing. They're pointless. I mean, Judi Dench probably thinks of the James Bond films, Notes on a Scandal, Philomena, as things she was actually in. I'm sure she has no recollection of even making this film.
She's probably got a few tchotchkes or maybe a rosary that Franco Zeffirelli gave yeah. to her.
I got this one from Cher.
Anyway, it all comes to a head when it becomes revealed that the hunky chauffeur is actually plotting to have Cher arrested and killed, or maybe be sent to a concentration camp. I mean, it's never exactly specified what he's going to do.
No, and the threat is never really that strong either.
She thinks that he's going to save her. Somehow, Luca and the other Italian women find this out, and for whatever reason, Cher won't believe them. She's just sitting in her hotel room, kind of being sad. And who is it left to come and convince her? Maggie Smith. So through the whole movie,
God, I barely remember any of this.
Yeah, I know. You left the room several times during
this
movie.
Yeah, I was like, I'm making some tea, don't pause the film.
So basically through the whole film, Maggie Smith is insisting that their hotel bill has been paid by Mussolini personally, when actually it's been paid by Cher. And so then finally they're like, oh, Cher won't run away with the resistance because she thinks that the chauffeur is going to save her. She hasn't believed Joan Plowright. She hasn't believed Judi Dench. She hasn't believed Luca. Maggie, you go tell her, because you hate her. So if you tell her to run away, then she'll know it's true. And you're like, what? This makes no dramatic sense. And also, the way that Maggie Smith finally learns that Mussolini hasn't paid the hotel bill is them turning to her and going, Hester, are you serious? The hotel bill wasn't paid by Mussolini. It was paid by Cher. And it's like, what?
That's a weird moment where they actually all call her Cher.
But honestly, like, I teach playwriting and dramaturgy on a regular basis. No events happen in this film.
Yeah, nothing.
The
nothing
only
happens.
Events that happen are enacted by Winston Churchill, Stalin, Mussolini, and Hitler. They are all external events. None of the characters in this movie do anything of any consequence or make any choice. So basically, Cher, you know, is convinced by Maggie and Luca to escape. She gets in a fishing boat. She sails off, you know, across the border into safety. I mean, I don't know what border she's going across.
She's going to Bosnia and Herzegovina, obviously.
And then in come the Allied forces eventually and save the women and Luca and liberate Italy. And then we get this scene. I thought finally we're going to get a little bit of blood, because Judi Dench is confronted, but the Nazis know they're on the run. They're yeah. about to be overcome. And they grab her fucking dog and they're about to shoot it with a Mauser.
Well, more than that, they're also about to blow up this church in which there's a fresco, so there's dynamite everywhere, okay? Judi Dench runs out into the line of fire.
Screaming like
okay?
a banshee.
She gets the cable, wraps it around herself, okay? You're like, she's going to get blown up. I actually, Brian, I've never been more excited to see someone potentially get killed in a film. Because I was like, there's something going to redeem this film.
Even
I
the
know
dog.
This.
I would love it if the dog had died.
Yes. Also, can I just say, that dog should be dead because it's old. You know? Okay, so get this. So how old is, what you call it? How old is Luke at the start of the film? He's like 5. Okay?
Yeah.
If even. How old is he by the end of it? 18, 19, okay? There is no way that dog is alive for 14
especially
years.
Especially during war yappy. Rations. Yeah.
Yeah, and still as yappy as it is, okay?
Okay, basically, this movie...
Oh, I hated this film.
This movie is a World War II film that makes The Sound of Music look like Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, if you thought that The Sound of Music was a bit too intense for you in terms of its portrayal of espionage and, you know, fascism on the rise, then Tea with Mussolini is exactly the film for you. Basically, there is this scene where three British character actors literally run at Nazis who are holding pistols at them and just bang them on the head, and they don't fire back or shoot or do anything other than run away. Surely some of these women could have died.
What I want to know is, who was Zeffirelli making this film for? Do you know what I mean?
Old ladies who go to the Lincoln Square Cinema in the Upper West Side
of
Manhattan.
You know, this film grossed $45 million, like on a $12 million budget.
You know, this film is catnip for a certain kind of audience member. And I think it makes me really appreciate Philomena, because Philomena is made for a very similar audience, yeah. And yet it is masterful.
Them. It respects them, it has depth. It's not afraid to tackle dark and meaningful subjects. This film would not wash with today's audiences.
I don't know, babe, because all you have to do is go to look at some other Judi Dench projects like Victoria and Abdul and the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel franchise and say to yourself, maybe Judy does have a tendency to pick socio-political stories of colonialism and British privilege that have a kind of dubious message.
And
maybe
don't
Judy
really
Dench,
offend anybody.
Maybe don't offend anybody. Victoria and Abdul, the trailer fucking offended me.
Well, Brian, you know, colonialism is fine, you know, when you have Judy Dench in it. Nobody notices.
Exactly. So, and then the movie ends on this long and lingering shot of the fresco that has yet again not been damaged. There's not a single chip in it, thanks to Judy's hard work with her dog at her side. And I was kind of waiting for a little coda where Cher returns and gives little boy Luca some sort of gift or present or something. Or at least a, like, post-credits, like, song or something from Cher, but Cher just fades away.
Yeah, kind of like a Mamma Mia dance number.
Yeah, exactly. We do actually get one completely ridiculous instance of Cher singing. So it's 1935, so I think they know that she can't sing, like, you know, Believe or something like that. So instead, she sings an old standard. It's, which one is it? It's Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. I mean, like, people in the 1930s sag like this. Heaven, I'm in heaven. You know, this sort of the, like, croaking frog kind of voice, you know, very thin and reedy. How does Cher sing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes?
Now laughing friends ride, tears I cannot hide, so I smile and say, when a lovely flame dies, smoke gets in your eyes.
It's honestly, it stands out more than anything else in the whole freaking
smoke
rest of the
through
film.
Your eyes. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my god. Well, we've finally seen Tea with Mussolini.
And we can never see it again. Great segue into the next film, Brian, which is something that you and I have both seen before, which we very happily rewatched again.
Yes and no. We're not going to give away what the final Judi Dench film is. I suppose I will only say that arguably, while this next film is our crazy segment, it may be Judi Dench's greatest on-screen performance ever.
Yes.
It is also a film about which I have deeply conflicting feeling.
And dear listeners, by now you know that I love a film with deeply reprehensible characters, and this is one of them.
Yes, it's absolutely scandalous, so get out your notebooks. If you haven't yet figured it out, we'll be teasing what this absolute shocker of a film is on our Twitter account at Broad Appeal Pod. But the next episode, the final Judi Dench installment, will be coming in your feed very, very soon.
Yes, can't wait.
And I just smile and say, when a lovely flame dies, smoke gets in your eye.
No matter how hard I try, smoke keeps getting in my eyes and I can't see through. And I can't breathe too.